Welcome to The Tax Factor, the top 20 business and investment podcast from Blick Rothenberg, the tax, accounting and business advisory firm, Election 24, with Rahana Earl and Robert Salter.
Welcome to The Tax Factor, the top 20 business and investment podcast, which brings you all the latest news and updates in the world of tax and provides analysis of what it might mean for you and your business. I'm Rahana Earl.
And I'm Robert Salter, again.
Yes, you're becoming quite a regular, aren't you, Robert? But I guess that's because you are the font of all election tax knowledge, which is fantastic for us.
I suspect it's because I'm cheap, really, but I'll take your compliments.
You do that. So, yes, we are continuing our election coverage, coming from our very own tax battle bus, which is still making its way around Covent Garden and Holborn. So if you see Robert or any of the other team, please give us a big cheer. Today, Robert, we're going to be talking about Labour and Reform and what they have in their manifestos, because they both announced their manifestos last week, just after we'd done the recording of last week's Tax Factor. Labour has got quite a lot going on in its manifesto, and the Reform Party have announced its manifesto, which is called Our Contract With You. I think it'd be great to cover off some of the key tax-related announcements, particularly obviously Labour are leading in the polls, and Reform are currently tracking about 5% behind the Conservatives. Robert, in terms of our dissection of the key parts of the Labour manifesto, from what I gather, their headline announcements are, and I'm going to rattle these off and then we can kind of go through them in a bit more detail. No increases to income taxes or to NIC. No rise in VAT for households, but VAT on school fees, which has been much kind of reported in the press. A tax for private equity, and we can go into that in a bit more detail. A cap on the current corporate tax rate of 25% for the duration of the next parliament, a rise in stamp duty paid by non-UK residents, and of course the change to the non-domicile rules, which again we have discussed quite a lot on previous episodes, and we'll continue to cover that in a bit more detail. So Keir's kind of take on his party's manifesto is about wealth creation and a promise that Labour won't increase taxes on working people, which is why they're holding, from what they've said, income tax rates, NIC, VAT, etc., as they are.
I'm actually quite sceptical of the Labour Party manifesto, at least when it comes to taxes, because it actually mentions very little in many of the specs. If you look at the tax increase, the additional taxes that they're talking about taking through things like the VAT on school fees and everything like that, and the non-domicile changes and the tightening they would have compared to what the Conservative Party's already announced, you're talking about something like £8 billion in taxes. Now, given that our total tax expenditure expenditure each year is give or take a trillion, that is literally minuscule in any meaningful sense. So either they are really going for growth, in which case they haven't really talked about how they're going to achieve this economic growth really in their manifesto, or they're keeping a lot back and will be increasing taxes somewhere down the line, or they're increasing debts. You've got, you know, those kind of scenarios. Now, obviously, they're going to benefit from one or two things anyway because of fiscal drag and the announcements that the Conservative Party and the last governments already announced to keep tax bans fixed, for example, until 2027-28. And that will give them 30 to 34 billion potentially of additional tax revenue anyway, in addition to all they specifically announced in the manifesto. But yeah, there's lots of ifs and buts and kind of black holes, I think, at the moment within the Labour Party manifesto. But, you know, even with the ones where they've specifically said X and Y, so with income taxes, no late increases, when I see no late increases, etc., there's still lots of things that they could increase. Well, there were lots of ways they could increase the tax take without actually breaking the terms of what they've officially said. So, for example, on income tax, at the moment, if you travel to work and you get car parking where you work, that's tax-free. They could easily make that a fixed-fee taxable benefit. So there's lots of things that they could do to increase tax if they wish to, while still officially hitting the T's and C's of what they've claimed in the manifesto.
So really, the devil is going to be in the detail, and it's the detail that we don't have to be able to give us that full picture.
A lot of the detail we don't have, yeah. Now, where they have actually said specific things, for example, about where would the VAT on school fees actually bring in what they say, I very much doubt. Certainly, if you look at this over a 4 or 5 year period, people, whether in school at the moment, will probably say, keep your children in the school if it's a private school. But would you put them in the private school going forward? Possibly not, because you may not be able to afford it. And the thing is, with things like private equity tax, where in a broad sense, the term is to basically rather have a lot of the income, for want of a better term, that private equity executives earn being officially classified as capital and taxed at 28%. The proposal is to treat it as income and put it at, say, 40 or 45%. But anybody who knows private equity would actually understand that the type of income you get under this 28% tax ban has various natures to it. Some of it will be possibly hidden income, and that you could argue, from a principal's perspective, should genuinely be treated as taxable as income tax at 40 or 45%. But a lot of the times, these executives are actually putting their own money into these companies. In principle, to be fair to the Labour Party, they have got somebody who did a study, or the IFS, who did a study about private school fees, and the number that they're coming up with for 1.5 billion is based on the study from the IFS. But I'm sorry, I don't personally believe those numbers. I think the numbers are wrong. Think tanks, however kind of well thought out, well researched they are, do get things wrong. And I do think it will genuinely result in people changing their behaviour. You know, we have gone through quite a tight period over the last 3-4 years. People are struggling financially, at least compared to where they were. You know, mortgage rates aren't going to go down to the really low levels we had 5-6 years ago. So people will be struggling financially, and that will, together with perhaps a 15% rise in school fees, change people's behaviour. I think the only reason I say 15% rise in school fees is because, rather than the 20%, which is the headline rate of VAT, is because to some extent the schools will be able to claim some VAT, input VAT back. So the 15% is probably more likely to be the genuine increase in cost. And that will change people's behaviour. The idea it won't is naive. You know, people who go to private schools, some of them could afford the 15% and not even blink. But there's a heck of a lot of people in that camp who are more normal taxpayers, if that's a fair term.
Yeah, I agree. We will have to see what happens on that front. And then coming back to the private equity stuff and Keir Starmer's assertion that the manifesto is all about wealth creation. Well, comparing the sort of a 45% rate on carried interest and things like that, when you compare that to other countries like France, Italy, Germany, which have rates between 26 and potentially 34% at the very higher end, with the US at 20% on similar types of income, is this really going to create the amounts that the Labour government, or Labour income and government potentially, will think it will, or will it actually backfire and turn into creating an uncompetitive UK position against other countries? And I think that's something that surely they have to consider when coming up with these types of manifesto pledges.
I agree they should be considering the wider position. And, you know, I'm quite cynical slash practical when it comes to tax. There's things that you can say, well, A is correct idealistically, for example, or B is correct idealistically or whatever. I don't need to give a hoot which what's correct idealistically. What actually helps you bring in the best balance between actually getting tax, but actually helping your economy grow, develop, etc. So what practically works? What's the practical impact of any change? You know, does it drive people out of the UK, for example? Because that doesn't help UK PLC. I think, especially when you consider so many of the private equity and venture capital kind of executives, they may live and work in the UK, but a lot of them will have links overseas. They may well have grown up overseas. A lot of them are international in their background and things like that. So they don't have to work and live in the UK necessarily. And given flex working since COVID, they could also just commute. And if they spend, you know, 2 or 3 days a week in the UK, that may be all they need to do the UK parts of their job. But if that's what happens in reality, we start to lose a lot in terms of their taxability in the UK, because we can only tax them on a limited basis rather than on the worldwide income. And things like capital gains would typically start to fall out of a UK tax charge.
Yeah, exactly. And that combined with the non-dom changes could mean that we see sort of an even greater exodus of that wealth from the UK, which is actually inputting into the overall tax system. And that needs to be taken into account in the overall numbers. You've got to look at the positive and the potential negative of this and actually come up with the balanced figure, which I don't think has been looked into. So one of the other announcements that the Labour Party have made is that they plan to increase stamp duty on UK property by 1% for those who are purchasing UK property who are not resident in the UK, and they're forecasting, I think, roughly that this will raise about 40 million. So currently buyers who are non-resident face a 2% surcharge on UK stamp duty rates, which will go up. Again, a question, do we think this is actually going to raise any extra revenue? Do we think UK property is still attractive enough for people to invest even if they're non-resident? Is that going to go somewhere else? I guess the electorate are going to have to decide when they make their decisions. Again, kind of what are your thoughts on that?
I think generally, you know, and I'm not an expert on stamp duty, but most people who study these things and are kind of academic study taxes always think stamp duties are very kind of badly designed tax. So I'll take their word for it. But at the end of the day, I think the 1%, 40 million a year, it's so marginal. I don't think that in itself will change behaviours. I think the issue as to whether the UK stays attractive for international investors, etc., will be depending on what the Labour Party does or whatever, but any party does in terms of the economic growth. The 1% in itself won't won't change behaviours. But if the UK is not doing well economically, for example, will people want to buy houses here? Quite possibly not.
I think that's probably enough on the Labour Party, Robert. So turning to Reform and their manifesto, what have they announced which you think is interesting from a tax perspective?
Well, they've certainly been very ambitious, I think you can say, from a tax policy perspective. If you compare all the manifestos from a tax perspective, the Reform Party and to some extent the Green Party have been the most kind of detailed as well in terms of their plans. Now, that's not to say the Reform Party plans actually kind of hold up particularly well when it comes cost to income. Black holes are definitely there. But the key things are, for example, they would increase the personal allowance, presently £12,570 a year, they would increase that to £20,000 a year. So that would take, you know, quite a lot of people out of tax, for example. And they've also looked at, and they've said they would increase the 20% band from the £50,000 or £50,270 it presently is up to £70,000. So again, that would take a lot of people who are presently caught by partly by a 40% tax band. That would take a lot of those people into the 20% band again. So there's things like that which would, in many respects, be quite attractive. You know, let's be honest, nobody wants to pay taxes at a higher rate if they can avoid it. Like I say, how's that going to be funded? I think it's quite a big black hole in terms of the funding side of things.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't stop there, does it, in terms of the promises? They've said that kind of all frontline NHS and social care staff will pay zero basic rate tax for 3 years, plus proposals on student loans for doctors, nurses, medical staff, etc. And again, sort of staying with the NHS, they've made a commitment to maintaining the NHS, but offering tax relief of 20% on all private healthcare and insurance to ease the pressure on the NHS. The pledges, they keep coming, but whether or not they can actually be funded, where's that coming from? I haven't seen that in their manifesto.
You know, they talk about, for example, reducing government expenditure by 5%, which is basically 50 billion a year. But where that would really be, that hasn't really been addressed. Whilst I think it is fair to say that some parts of government will be inefficient and there will be some waste, that's probably true of any organisation and definitely true of the public sector generally. There's also lots of pressure on other bits and things like that. So whilst you may be able to take a few hundred million here or there from certain government departments, that doesn't mean you should take it out of the system fully. You should perhaps be going in other areas as well, moving it alone rather than just kind of cutting. The idea you can continually cut, I personally don't think is valid. And, you know, whether it's the Ministry of Defence, whether it's potholes on the road, etc., there's definitely public service issues out there, whether it's the fact that some state schools are obviously having concrete that's falling apart now and things like that. There's lots of issues there. They haven't mentioned those type of things where actually, if anything, we need more money being spent, not less. For the party, which talks about simplification, both in terms of some of the labour law stuff and the wider economic stuff and some of the green agenda and things like that. And they talk about trying to reduce the size of the kind of tax legislation book in the UK to, they talk about the Hong Kong, 500 pages of tax legislation is all you need, allegedly. All these proposals that they're having actually, in many cases, make the system more complicated. So you have different tax bands and different tax rates for NHS staff and social care staff compared to the general public. Well, that's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think that will just make things more complex, as you say, and they're going to try and cut down 21,000 pages. I don't think that's going to happen, you know, unfortunately. I know one other thing that they've mentioned is abolishing the IR35 rules as well. I know that's a very important topic for us. We often talk about IR35 cases on the tax factor.
Yeah, and you know, the moving IR35, which is the regulations about personal service companies where somebody works through their own personal service company and provides services to other clients. And are they, for PAYE purposes, deemed client or deemed employee, the end client, things like that? It's not good legislation. In some ways, getting rid of IR35 would certainly have my approval. But it's, again, I would say, needs to be considered as part of a wider package in terms of, okay, you get rid of IR35, but what does that mean from a labour law perspective? Are you going to have them matched up, for example, or not, and things like that? Because at the moment, there's lots of hiccups and questions there that, again, I don't think it's fully addressed. It's interesting to note that actually when they do their manifesto, they refer to IR35 impacting sole traders. Actually, it's not sole traders who get caught by IR35. That's different legislation. IR35 is very much like IT contractors working with their own company. So again, they talked about X or Y, but perhaps not fully understood the real nature of the legislation and when it applies and things like that. Again, it's one of those things that is potentially good, but do they fully understand it?
Yeah, and I suppose even just having it on the agenda might be a positive though, because I think, yeah, as tax professionals, we've all been sort of calling for simplification of the rules for a very long time. And so to get it back on the table in terms of debating it and what is right and making it easier for people to understand is a positive.
It's certainly something that needs to be changed, but I would like to see it change as part of a wider labour law / tax consideration review, whereas at the moment, you can get a lot of these contractors in the worst of both worlds, taxed as a regular employee, not getting holiday pay, not getting employer pension contributions, not entitled to sick pay, etc., etc. And that is a bit of a double whammy, not something I think that's really fair.
Yeah, or sustainable in the longer term. Sounds like there are lots of promises from both parties, also lots of unknowns out there, which makes it certainly from a tax perspective hard, I think, for the electorate to really get to grips with what the numbers are actually going to be like. We are very much relying on the numbers that have been pushed out there, the studies that have been done. But I think, as with anything, we have to question them, dissect them, and really think about what that might look like if a certain party does come into power.
I think, agreed, absolutely. And I think you have to assume if Labour win, there will be additional taxes somewhere down the line. We don't know at what stage and, you know, how it will exactly look. But like I say, if they go for growth and growth works, and that could, you know, legitimately provide them with more spending power. Absolutely. But that's quite a big if. And then, you know, what if that doesn't happen? What if that doesn't happen? And there's plenty of what ifs there.
Yeah, definitely going in with eyes wide open, I think. So turning away from elections and manifestos and promises that will most likely be broken, are there any interesting tax cases out there this week, Robert, that you want to talk about?
Yes, there was actually one that I found, and it's only a first-tier tribunal case. So obviously, it's not absolutely binding law when these things come out. As I'm sure you'll agree, Lahanna, it's amazing how HMRC are very willing to take first-tier tribunal kind of decisions which work in their favour as, you know, proper law, whilst obviously if it doesn't go in their favour, they say, well, it's not binding because it's only the first year. But the case I'm talking about is a case called Allah Muhammad versus HMRC. And it's basically a case involving tax remittances. So it's actually a case linked into somebody who was not domiciled in the UK, who hadn't been in the UK for a number of years, and then they came back into the UK. It's kind of linked into a business, actually. I'm trying to kind of reset up a business in the UK. Now, they had historically had money that was in a what we call a clean capital account. And basically, the banking went a bit kind of cockeyed, and it ended up being a tainted fund. So it had a lot of clean capital in it, but it has some interest and dividend income as well, which is, if it's brought into the UK, taxable and remittable to the UK. And the case is related to things like university fees, for example. So his adult children within the UK, and, you know, there are obviously accommodation in the UK, fees in the UK, etc., living costs for the kids to pay. And he was having those payments from that bank account going to, you know, the university, to the accommodation provider and things like that. Now, the question, therefore, was whether that was a remittance for tax purposes, because the kids were adults and they weren't children, etc., and they weren't directly going to them, they were going to things like the university and the accommodation provider and everything. So whether that was a remittance for tax purposes, and also whether HMRC was allowed to use discovery assessments for some of the earlier years relating to this case, on the basis everybody was accepting that these were innocent mistakes. They were mistakes, but they weren't, you know, deliberate tax behaviours or anything like that. They were just a mistake. So it was kind of a 50-50 decision at the end of the day. The court said this is a remittance for tax purposes, even though it's for the benefit of the adult children, because everything was being initiated by Mr. Allah Hamad, as in the adult, the guy who had the funds, etc. So it was considered to be a taxable remittance, even though, like I say, the beneficiary in effect was typically the children in most cases. But they weren't able to go back as much as they wanted to, because the revenue accepted, they were, you know, this wasn't dodginess on the part of the individual or anything like that. It was just an innocent mistake. And they couldn't just assume it was deliberate behavior or deliberate tax evasion or avoidance or anything like that. You had, you know, where there's no evidence to that effect. It was an innocent mistake. Therefore, they couldn't go back and open the kind of the closed years under the discovery assessment, T's and C's. And it was literally just bound by the regular Section 9A, 12 months after the filing deadline kind of time window.
Yeah. So again, sort of bringing home how complex remittances are, especially when you've got mixed funds, etc. We always say get the right advice, hopefully some simplification if the non-dom rules change around kind of bringing funds into the UK as we go forward. But certainly some historic stuff to potentially look at, and people still need to be very aware.
And this historic stuff will last for another 5 or 10 years before it's all sorted out. Absolutely. But yes, as you said, one of the benefits of moving to the foreign income and gains FIG regime, which is the kind of the new proposals from April 25 onwards, is that the bank account type stuff will be a lot simpler, and that will be better in many cases for those who can still benefit from the system.
Yep, exactly.
The Tax Factor, Election 24.
So that's all we have time for today. My thanks to Robert for joining me on this week's Tax Factor and sharing all of his views on the Labour and Reform Party manifestos.
Thank you for having me. You can keep track of our election coverage and insights on our website, blickrothenberg/election24. I think the production team have had enough of me. Next week, Heather Self is back with Neil Insull. I'm sure both will have some interesting views on the party's promises and what the next few months may look like. It's goodbye for me.
And me. I'm Rihanna Earle. Thanks for listening and have a fantastic weekend.
That's The Tax Factor. We'd like to thank you for making us one of the UK's top 20 podcasts. Find all our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And join us again next time on The Tax Factor.